So next we have a report from our State Water Resource Control Board liaison, Mr. Steve Moore. So welcome back to our meeting.
Regional board members and staff and folks from the Central Coast region. I'm Stephen Moore, board member on the State Water Board and liaison to the Great Central Coast region. And happy to be here today. I think last time you met was in Santa Barbara, and DDD Adamo, my fellow State Water Board member, joined you there. So hopefully she gave you a different insight into things. That was my hope, was to encourage my colleagues to come to the regions I usually visit, and I'm also doing that next week. I'm going to Reading to visit with folks up there and learn about a ton of different things they're doing. So speaking of a ton of different things, I could be here for a long time going over everything going on, but I wanted to let you know a couple big picture things, just the goings-on of the State Water Board. I guess, change, the only thing that's constant is change, and so our vice chair, Fran Spivey Weber, is retiring. And her last day is next Wednesday, March 15th. Tam Dodek, her term has expired, and she's applied to be reappointed. And we don't know. We hope that she will be reappointed, and we'll know that by midweek next week. Also, our executive director, Tom Howard, is retiring in June. And so we've already announced that opening and beginning the process of selecting a new executive director for the State Water Board. Well, as always, I like to go over some budget issues, and then I'll talk about recent things we've been doing, I've been doing, upcoming things you might be interested in, and then just really brief comments on legislation that's being considered these days. On the budget, we're right around $1 billion in the governor's proposed budget in January each year. We get that. And, the chairs, we engaged this year maybe in a more open, transparent way with the chairs and in our state board staff and trying to fashion budget change proposals that address staffing needs and, contract money needs in our regions. And it's interesting, when we looked at what we really need in the irrigated lands regulatory program, I think we came up with a figure of 32 positions, because if you really look at the numbers, we're borrowing a lot from other programs to regulate the irrigated lands program, not just here in this region, but in other regional boards. So in October timeframe, the Department of Finance, as you've heard, we've been pretty fortunate the last few years in getting positions to address issues, whether it's oil and gas issues or underground storage tanks and irrigated lands to some extent. Well, we got a big flat no in October, November timeframe based on all that work we did to pull together five different BCPs. But our staff, John Russell and others, worked hard to make the case, and I think having the chairs and the regional board members weighing in on priorities strengthen that case. So the upshot is, instead of 32 positions, the governor's proposed budget is five new positions. That's better than zero, which is what we were told in November. So to give you a little insight into sort of the dynamics that we deal with. Also, there's an increase of $1 million in the Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Administration Fund to support Dogger in its annual review of the Class 2 underground injection control projects. We also have about four positions in timber harvesting, seven positions in the underground storage tank cleanup fund. These are additional to what we already have to deal with the backlog of settling claims in that fund. We also have a one-time general fund to deal with drought enforcement issues. So folks who, didn't report or or who diverted when they weren't supposed to and that sort of thing. We're doing follow-up enforcement actions for that historic drought that seems to have been replaced by a historic deluge, which, you know, at this time I can take a breather and think about, you know, I was appointed in 2012, and here's 2017. So 2013 was the driest calendar year in history, in California history. 2014 was the hottest year in California history. 2015 had the lowest snowpack in 500 years. 2016 was an average year when it was supposed to be El Nino. And now 2017 has turned out to be the wettest year in California history. Certainly in the northern and central Sierra, we have more precipitation now than we've ever seen before. And in the Tulare Basin, it's inching up to the record level. So it's still kind of a north-south gradient. So that then brings me to a recent item we adopted with a lot of help from the regional boards and the different divisions across our agency. We adopted a resolution on climate change, the Water Board's comprehensive response to climate change, and this was this week. And this is something that Vice Chair Fran Spivey Weber championed, you know, as our climate representative with the multi-agency groups, the Water Energy Nexus group. And so it was a fitting farewell for Fran to get this resolution adopted on her last board meeting. And Felicia Marcus wasn't there because of a family emergency situation, so actually Fran, in her final board meeting, presided as the acting chair. So it was actually a great experience. And it was interesting because we got 50 comment letters on this resolution. And really, you know, we tried to explain that it's an internal document in a lot of ways. What we did is we worked across divisions, the regional boards, and identified program areas very specifically in these whereases and resolves, you know, in terms of what actions that we would take and how we interact with the issue of climate change in different programs, whether it's Division of Financial Assistance, Division of Water Quality, Division of Water Rights, Division of Drinking Water. And so it was a breaking down the silos exercise that Max Gomberg, our staff person, really was really championed. And also I want to recognize Yelena Hartman, our staff person, who did a lot of hard work to integrate insights from different regions. As you know, climate change means different things to different regions, and we get a taste of that, the WQCC. So, but yeah, like I said, a lot of comments, concerns, you know, and really what this is, it's a lot like the Human Right to Water resolution that we did about a year ago. We're just going to recognize and give staff at the regional boards, and it's optional, you know, we don't direct the regional boards, but we encourage you to use this as a tool to demonstrate how you're addressing either climate mitigation or climate adaptation in all your actions, and it's up to you. But this gives you a template to point to if you should choose to. All right, so moving on. You know, at the chair's call, we talked about the stormwater program and the issue of the unfunded mandates court case. And, you know, what does that mean to our ongoing regulatory program? And we keep reminding folks, these are duly adopted NPDES permits for MS4 discharges. They're fully enforceable. But going forward, we have to do a better job, like with many other processes, of documenting how we are following federal requirements and in the specifics of the permit requirements that we adopt for stormwater discharges, and that we're not doing a quote-unquote true choice of an independent state requirement of the federal program. And it's interesting because Michael Laufer, our chief counsel, laid out you know, the upcoming work in our program and how legal staff believe we aren't facing challenges with unfunded mandates in upcoming actions, specifically the Phase 2 MS4 statewide permit that we at the State Water Board adopt and this region, more than any other region, implements. So it's the opinion of legal staff that the Phase 2 permit does not raise unfunded mandates issues, nor does another permit coming up in the Lahontan region for Lake Tahoe. Really, when you look at the specifics of the permit language, the next challenge is likely to be the Ventura County MS4 permit issued by Los Angeles Regional Board, because there are some requirements there that are a little more prescriptive and may be tested by the unfunded mandates question. I thought that was an interesting discussion because it brings it home to our work day to day. In the drinking water world, you may remember that SB 828 was passed to establish a drinking water for schools grant program, and it gives us $9.5 million from the general fund to award grants to local educational institutions for the purpose of improving access to and the quality of drinking water in our public schools. And so we're going to have about $500,000 to fund technical assistance, including, you know, completing applications, overseeing installations, and assisting with O&M. And it's still in the early stages of development, so this is upcoming work. In April, we expect to have a resolution that would approve the executive director to approve contracts for this technical assistance for schools. On the stormwater program, I'm sure you're aware, or staff are aware, but there were implementation grants for stormwater resource plans that were approved very recently, including the Monterey Regional Water Pollution Control Agency for $10 million, folks in the audience, and also the Pacific Grove Project for $4.5 million, and Santa Maria, almost $1 million implementation grant for stormwater. This follows on the heels of the stormwater planning grants that we awarded. So not everyone who got a planning grant is in this round of implementation, but there's going to be another round of implementation. So I think of the five cities as an example. I always look at those streets in Grover Beach. What are they, 150 feet wide and paved? You know, there's a lot of opportunity there for re-engineering the transportation system to benefit water. Some other recent happenings. You may have heard about our project to update mercury water quality objectives, and it's linked with beneficial use definitions for tribal uses and subsistence uses for fishing for subsistence. And there's controversy there. There's concern that we would set standards that would be potentially unattainable. But we're working in respect for the tribal use of fish. It goes back tens of thousands of years, and it's more focused on trophic level 3 fish, which are salmon and trout and that sort of thing, that don't accumulate pollutants as much. So when you really dig into the science and the study that UC Davis did on tribal subsistence fishing, you know, it doesn't look, from my standpoint, like an impossible task there. But there's issues with the assumptions on how much fish is consumed and then what number in the fish tissue would be required to meet as a cleanup goal or as a water quality standard. So we had a workshop in early February on this issue, and we've been having staff-level workshops. There was concern about water rights and in-stream flows to support tribal uses of water, and so there was ongoing discussion on what the reality is behind that. I know you all are tracking the oil and gas issue closely, and Dogger accepted public comments on this aquifer exemption proposal for San Ardo. There was a public hearing held in King City in February. You may have attended, and so we're our deputy director, chief deputy director John Bishop, is the point person at our agency on these issues, and your former executive officer. And you know, just a point of clarification, you know, the primary focus of the Water Board's review of these exemption proposals is to ensure the protection of the current and future beneficial use of water, and we regularly collaborate with Dogger on these revisions and the technical information provided in each proposal. And just as a number, we've received 29 proposals statewide, and we've preliminarily concurred, with 16 out of those 29. And so there's still, you know, the other 13 that we need more information about the water quality issues. All right. Been rambling along here. Upcoming things going on. You mentioned SGMA a lot in your reports. Good to hear. I mean, I'm really happy to hear that you're engaged in the SGMA discussions. It's very serious. We're having a board meeting on March 22nd. We're going to propose a fee schedule for SGMA to pay for our state water board staff if we have to intervene to manage the basin. And we're also going to have electronic SGMA reporting item on that in that board meeting in a couple weeks. We'll have an emergency regulation on May 16th to adopt SGMA fees. It'll be a lot like the fee schedules we adopt annually for our different programs. We've been working closely with stakeholders on this. It's very interesting because in some parts of the state, when we had our initial fee proposal, many thought they were too low, that we didn't provide enough incentive for people to take ownership of the local programs. Oh, well, if we can pay that, we'll just let the state take it. That was an interesting dynamic. But in other areas, it was the opposite. It was the state coming in to take over. So it's been a back and forth, a very productive discussion. And as with anything, we're trying to get the right touch, the right level of incentive, and pay for our staff's time in this uncharted territory. We're going to have a workshop in May on the East San Joaquin Agricultural Order, petition of the Region 5 Agricultural Order on May 16th. And we're going to release for public comment the updated dredge and fill policy, you know, the quote-unquote wetlands policy, also in May. Things coming up. You've been involved with the discussions on general permits for wineries. And currently we have anticipate by next year, January or so, to have a release for public comment of a statewide general permit for wineries. So we know we need to coordinate with the regional boards on that and doing what we can to really improve that coordination. Some regions have adopted these type of orders. Some are working on them. You've been working on them somewhat. We're interested in creating a kind of a one-stop shop for wineries and think maybe if we can figure it out together, the statewide order might be the place because then you can do the stormwater requirements, discharge requirements, and everything in one vehicle. That's an ideal, but we'll continue to work toward that. And you all always hear about the conservation. We're pleased about the progress on this. And I mean, Governor Brown, in his executive order last year, really gave us a clear directive. And our staff worked with DWR and others and stakeholders to draft the long-term water conservation efficiency framework. And perhaps you've seen it. We anticipate by the end of this year to adopt permanent conservation regulations for urban water reporting and prohibition of wasteful water uses to sort of, you know, wrap up that whole experience of cutting back on our water use as Californians. And I'll leave maybe on the legislation I was going to talk about is looking at that. You know, we may do a trailer bill type approach, you know, to get the authorities to set standards that are reasonable for water use, water budget approach that's in this report. But also there's legislation being developed by NRDC, AQUA, and others, so it's a very hot topic. But I'll leave on this high note, a positive note, that in January 2017, Californians used less water per capita than ever before. We went down the whole statewide average per capita gallons per capita per day, residential, 58.1. That's remarkable. And that has everything to do with Californians' acceptance of the challenge, of the reality, and it's exciting to work in this area because we've had so much success, thanks to our culture, right? And everybody's hard work. I think it's just, you know, then I'll say, kind of down to earth, you know, it rained all January long, and this time, for the first time in history, people turned off their sprinklers. Well, you know, we're learning to do that. It's like, oh, yeah. It's amazing what you can accomplish when you just pay attention. All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Steve. Looking on my left, Ms. Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. I just wanted to say thanks for the presentation. I applaud the resolution on climate change. Also wanted to give kudos to your GSA staff. I think they've been really excellent in communicating with stakeholders in the process, very transparent and open and extremely flexible and easy to work with. So if you could pass that along.
Thank you.
Sure. And then in relation to the human right to water, I'm very pleased to see the portal and just had a question that's maybe a little bit beyond the scope of state, but I was wondering how you're working with the Department of Water Resources to implement that. Is that particularly through the Division of Financial Assistance in terms of implementing those affordability and access guidelines? And then what's happening with California Water Action Plan? Are you also interacting on that with the human right to water?
Yeah, thank you. Certainly, the safe, affordable drinking water issue is very, very important. And we had a February 8th workshop, and it's probably something I probably should have told you about. It's running out of the time. So thank you for those questions. Excellent. Our work with Department of Water Resources is definitely improving, and data management and open data and transparent data and the new law, AB 1755, has created a vehicle for us to collaborate even more. And Greg Gearhart is the head of our Office of Information and Management and Analysis, and he's trying to help DWR come along, because you mentioned the portal for human right to water. That's one example of how the State Water Board and the regions have kind of pushed the envelope on open data. And the California Water Quality Monitoring Council, which was headed by John Marshak for years, he's going to retire this year, another change, they've pioneered open data. You know, they have the My Water Quality Portal. And, you know, and here in Region 3, there's been that pioneering of the CCAMP program and making this information available and open. So getting back to, you know, DWR and us are starting this new relationship within the framework of that law. And some of the principles there that we're trying to bring them along with is the idea that we're not going to make a new giant database. We're going to take our existing 8 or 9 water board databases, stormwater, CEDIN, et cetera, and make sure that the flow of that data, it can be made into flat files and that people can do data analysis based on data flow requirements. So we're really having that kind of a discussion with the Department of Water Resources. I know the impetus of that law had a lot to do with more transparency in how they do water transfers, because the Bay Area Council sponsored the law, and they wanted to see the water market open up better and thought this open data approach would help. And we agree, but then we also see the value of engaging the public, educating them, engaging academia, engaging researchers, anyone from local government who needs that data can be at their fingertips. So it's something we have to continue to work on. The affordable, safe drinking water, that was a very informative, detailed workshop we had on February 8th. It's on the web, and you can some expert insight into the issue of affordability. And we had a good testimony from Cal Water Service, who provide water supply for Salinas, and many other communities around the state. And they have a low income rate assistance program, or LIRA, and they talked about how they finance that. And investor-owned utilities are less than 20% of the water agencies or the customer base in the state. Over 80% are public water agencies. But it seems that the private water agencies have figured out the lifeline rate approach or that works for them, and that was part of the discussion about how public agencies could benefit from that experience. This is one thing we talked about.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
So, Mr. Young, you had questions?
Good morning, Mr. Moore. Thank you. Good to see you again.
Yeah.
On the five new PYs that we're getting for the irrigated lands program, how are those being distributed amongst the water boards?
Yeah, that'll be a knockdown, drag out. No, I mean, I'm sorry. That'll be a productive discussion at the MCC, right, John? Executive officers will take that up, and it works out pretty well, you know, in terms of figuring out what the workload is, and you know, that tends to be a pretty cooperative process. But right now, it's just a proposal. It's in the governor's proposed budget, so we'll see what happens as it goes through.
We can simplify the process, you know, making five position in Region 3.
Just put them here.
Done.
And then with the climate change resolution, how does that specifically affect the regional boards?
Yeah, you know, it's
as advice, because you said it's really advisory.
It's advisory. It's in every clause in this resolution, it's 6 or 7 pages. It says the state water board staff shall, and the regional boards are encouraged to, X, Y, Z. And so it just, you know, we're looking at those aspects of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and encouraging it.
Right, and how do the regional boards actually encourage that?
I think, you know,
through what?
We talked about it a bit in the hearing. You know, we aren't interested in getting outside of our authorities here. And, you know, in the Coast Keeper testimony, they were a little disappointed, they said, on there didn't seem to be a lot of teeth on the climate mitigation section. But when we talked about it in the hearing, you know, we're not interested in taking over emission regulation at all. What we're trying to do is just give staff a pathway to say, hey, you know, because the question will always be there. Water boards, how are you addressing climate change in this action? And this resolution gives you, you know, a checklist, things to consider and encourage, you know, in the permitting action. So we're not taking over that regulatory program. We're using this to just show that we're taking climate change into account.
So could you share any of the specific recommendations? I'm just really so curious, because knowing that our authority is in water quality, how we ever get into touching on CO2 and methane emissions.
Well, right. You know, and I think, you know, in the NPDES permits for the discharge, you know, we can acknowledge the good work of local governments to invest in resource recovery at the wastewater treatment plants. You know, it's not that we will require it, but this gives us the ability to engage in these discussions. You know, have you thought about doing this? You know, because we know there's not one size fits all, as they say. You know, smaller treatment plants can't necessarily do cogen. The technology is not there. You need to have a big facility to get
and
methane.
If I may, Steve, add a little bit to that. When water has a big energy component and the 80% of water in its cost is the energy. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to move around water and to purify water. So the consequence of that is that as you conserve water and as you recycle water, you basically can recycle that energy that has been used to produce that water. And every kilowatt of energy has a translation into CO2 emission. So as a matter of fact, when performing the calculations with LEED, you have to include the water component, and it actually has a significant element to it.
So is this really just limited to wastewater treatment plants?
No, I'll just give it to you as an example.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Because, you know, if you take which today will be very appropriate in our presentation, if you take water that has to gone through treatment and by recycling that water rather than letting that water discharge into the ocean, you basically take that amount of energy that you have invested in and recycle it. I mean, just as a simple example.
Okay. And then last question has to do with SGMA. And are you aware of any interventions on the horizon that might seem more likely now than before with respect to the State Water Board having to get involved in taking over a groundwater basin?
Right, temporarily, until the locals can get up and running. We have a list.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you who's on it.
That's okay. I'm just would be so interested to see how that actually comes down and the reactions of everybody. Okay.
But this is all, in the end, this is a lot like the school districts. This is what Fran Pavley said on the floor when she was making her case for SGMA, which she co-authored. And she said, the state doesn't want to get in the business of running school districts whatsoever, but if there is administrative or fiscal issues, there's authority for the state to come in, get things going, and then get out. And that's a lot like what this is about. So we just want to make sure we have, the infrastructure, as it were, the human infrastructure ready to deal with this. We're going to strongly encourage folks to manage the basins themselves.
What's the drop dead date then for?
Well, the June 30th, 2017.
Wow.
Is the formation of the groundwater sustainability agencies.
Okay.
I think the state's been effective, frankly, in getting people to the table. I think the threat of state intervention on a temporary basis has really been an impetus for strong collaboration. That's sort of what I've borne witness to. So.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we're really, we walk and talk the local, the strong preference for local management and trying to provide every incentive we can to make that happen.
Yeah, I'm sure that has been the reaction, but I'm just kind of curious, from the perspective of wanting maybe to see some interesting theater take place.
I get enough interesting theater. I didn't even tell you about the Bay Delta Plan hearings. There were the 5 days of hearings in the last couple of months. But speaking of theater, though, I was in your neighborhood. The Drought Task Force was in Santa Barbara right as we were getting record rain. It was very fascinating. But it seems to have been working really well. The local agencies have gotten together and working with Cal OES.
That's how you have to make it rain.
Yeah.
That you have to hold a drought task force. It's like going outside, with your umbrella.
Yep, I think you're right.
Okay, so I think Mr. Johnson, and then Mayor Delgado after.
I'm just curious, in terms of the climate change resolution, and I'm sure you as a old wastewater treatment hand would be very on top of this. In our region, all that stuff flows downhill, and in our region, that means that most of the waste treatment plants are sited very close to sea level. Can you talk just a little bit about how the resolution dealt with the question of waste treatment plants and sea level rise?
It did. There's a finding. There's a couple findings in climate adaptation that you can point to, and we really tried. We strove for clarity and conciseness in this resolution. So there's a finding about wastewater and water infrastructure within coastal areas, and the need to look at infrastructure updating in those areas and helping to provide regulatory and financial incentive for it. So it's definitely called out as a sea level rise adaptation issue. Something that staff can use that language, and Another example is the vulnerability of disadvantaged communities. They tend to be the ones whose wells dry up when the water table falls, and other issues. And so that's called out as well. So it's, we're not getting into the climate regulation business. It's something we can point to in our discussions as kind of a guidance principles document. These are things you're doing already. You know, the regional board leadership on recognizing climate adaptation is throughout this document, I believe.
Okay, Mayor Delgado.
Director Young was talking about interventions, and you said you had a list. And my question is on that. Is there any update on how the State Water Board is going to handle overlapping applications? So I guess there's one possibility where nobody steps up. The other and that requires intervention. The other possibility is what's going on in the Salinas River Basin, where two agencies, including Marina Coast Water District, have submitted overlapping applications for the Monterey Subbasin. So just wondering, we talked about this, I think, a couple months ago or a couple meetings ago, but is there any update on how the State Water Board plans to handle those kinds of interventions?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and, you know, I would really defer to staff on that. As Board Member Gray noted, they're really engaging with folks, and we're going to do everything we can to come up with an amicable solution, but we're looking at those first principles, you know, of sound, sustainable groundwater management and the importance of institutional coordination and consolidation where necessary, really just for effective management fiscally and, you know, from a water resources protection standpoint. So I can't really lay out a process for you, but these principles, you know, we're looking for local agencies to set aside jurisdictional boundary battles and really look at basin-wide management. You know, that can be done cooperatively within, you know, jurisdictions that overlap or not. And so we want to allow creativity in those areas, you know. But we want this to be taken seriously on a basin approach, a watershed approach. The wisdom is that's how the best way to manage it.
So if two local agencies can't come together or can't agree, do you see the Water Board in principle being in the mediator position or just the intervener until they eventually agree?
Yeah, you know, I'm open-minded. I would want to ask staff their opinion on, you know, the specifics of a certain situation. But I'm comfortable with us playing that role of gathering the parties together and coming up with a more sustainable institutional arrangement.
Okay. My only other question, I was surprised yesterday when we were doing the irrigated ag waiver order that there was a neonicotinoid that was being heavily used in wine. Can someone help me out with that? Was that a midichlorian? And so you said next January, I think you said that you're going to have a state winery, a permit for wineries. Are you moving toward tiering or moving away from tiering when it comes to that upcoming permit?
Yeah, I wish I could give you that insight. Again, I need to ask staff, but I think we like tiering. You know, because in the winery world, there's really a different scales. So I would be open to that. I don't know the latest from Tim O'Brien is the staff person to check in with about that, what the latest is. I haven't gotten a briefing in about 8 months.
But you're not aware of a wave of policy going away from tiering?
I'm not aware of that, no.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Hunter?
You're getting the whole group here involved.
You do this to Dee Dee when she was here?
Well, you know, your reports are always so comprehensive. You always pique our interest. And two things. First, I'm glad that you mentioned the human right to water recent workshop that was held by State Board, and I just want to point out to folks in the room that State Water Board live streams all of these hearings and workshops, and so I did have an opportunity to listen in, and knowing that stakeholders travel from across the state, it's always very, very informative to hear from different regions. So that's our chance to stay informed. So yesterday, as you heard, we did review the conditional waiver for irrigated lands, which was approved, and with a lot of hard work and a lot of important input from stakeholders. One of the items that was discussed by a range of stakeholders was the issue of replacement water. There's some language in the order referring to our authority to use cleanup and abatement funding for replacement water, which is a good thing. But at this point, I think, and you've been very generous in your time in traveling to the region to participate with us in our outreach to disadvantaged communities that are in these small clustered areas that don't qualify. They're not even on the radar as disadvantaged communities. They're so small and they're relying on domestic wells. And with assistance from EJCW, we have identified particular households that we know are consuming contaminated water. And this board has provided, with some assistance from State Board, funding for replacement water, which we know is the only way to deal in the short term with these very urgent needs for reducing impacts or eliminating impacts to human health. At this point, I'm aware that we've extended our funding, and please staff comment if I'm out of date with this, but we've extended funding now, but our limit hits in July, and so I can't recall, there may be as many as 30 or 40 residential homes that are receiving replacement water. But when those funds end, the replacement water ends. And I don't know at this point what other doors are open to us, but I would also add that we are now aware, because of the data we've been collecting on domestic well testing, we also know that there are people that are drinking contaminated water that are not receiving a replacement water in any form. So, as we gather more data, the awareness is there, but the action of replacement water, it seems to be out of our reach. Can you tell me what that looks like from your perspective and your understanding of how the state is moving? And what can we do from our end to engage with State Water Board on these particular homes that are receiving replacement water currently?
Good. Yes, there's a, they call them the state smalls, which are the systems of less than 15 connections.
Well, I think in this case we're talking about just individual domestic private wells.
Sure. So, yeah,
Maybe less than five hookups.
Right. So it's that kind of a no man's land.
Right.
And about a year ago, I think it was November, December 2015, we did we created a program to deal with those smaller systems through the Division of Drinking Water and created a pipeline there. I know it's a problem we haven't completely defined. You know, at the workshop last month, we learned that based on the regulated system, 15 connections and above, there are 309 communities with unsafe drinking water in the state. But that's in our regulatory program. Then if you go, that's 309 communities, hundreds of thousands of people have unsafe drinking water. That's not acceptable. And that's just that population. And then there, as you point out, a host of folks that have less than 15 connections. So we tried to create a pathway, pipeline that way. I was looking at some of my notes here. You know, last year we did approve up to $4 million in July, and then in August set up guidelines for distribution of emergency drinking water replacement. And so I know our staff are ready and willing and able to to use that resource. And we're always looking that that's connected to a long-term solution. So right. that you don't have that situation where it just drops off the face of the earth.
Right.
But this, you know, I guess I'll then make a commentary that this is why the cleanup and abatement account is so important. It's created this safety net during the drought, and it's helped out disadvantaged communities with drinking water. And so the fines that we collect in our enforcement actions, by putting some of that in the cleanup and abatement account, we create this ability to provide emergency drinking water.
Well, I hope that you'll take this back with you to staff and alert them to this July sunset for these folks that we have been providing water to. And I just want to end by repeating a comment made by Horacio Mesquita, who has been such an incredible voice for these folks and communities, who points out that these are not people that have the opportunity or the option to move to areas where they can have safe drinking water. They are reliant on the work in the region, and in particular, farm workers are essential to the economy here. So they really are a necessary part of our community in terms of the work they contribute. And so assisting with solutions, but more importantly, finding these Band-Aid, you know, actions, these little bridges between processes and programs. We're quite a ways from seeing how that money is actually going to be distributed or look at this micro scale, if you will. But in particular, if you can alert staff, we really need some assistance with these particular folks who are getting emergency water now.
I'll bring it up. And meanwhile, though, we've benefited tremendously from the actions of the nonprofits, you know, the EJCWs of the right, world. Right. Community water centers, who help identify where these problems are, and then we bring to bear whatever resources we can. So I know that we'll move quickly as soon as issues are brought to our attention.
Thank you.
And I wanted to circle back just very quickly on Sigma, where, you know, there's a division of responsibility between DWR and State Board, and, you know, and there's been folks on the outside saying, gee, you know, what's the State Board involvement? And, you know, aside of taking a regulatory role by default. And, you know, I think there's another element of benefit associated with the engagement of state and regional board in being part of a solution with Sigma. You know, my personal view is that every basin designated should have a mission statement that includes water augmentation, water conservation, and innovation, because conservation alone is not going to provide a long-term solution to bring basin back in sustainability. So augmentation is a big element of it. And this is where I think the role of regional board and state board can assist in encouraging, you know, recycled water projects. Again, today's agenda item will be a perfect example, because that's part of a solution. And so that's one point that, you know, and as you had noticed, I attended quite a few meetings and tried to be maybe inspiring a little bit the importance of embedding local solutions of augmentations, and particularly our central coast, being coastal areas, we do have these opportunities because, you know, we still have millions of gallons of water every day that are discharged into the ocean, and I think the term wastewater is a word of the past. And then my last little bit, and it's a slight tangent, but back to the importance of climate change, is that there is an interesting shift in water treatment facilities where they become exemplary as being recyclers, because they recycle water, but increasingly recycle the gas production. So we see more and more water treatment plant installing biodigesters, so they capture the gas, they have their own cogeneration, produce electricity, And they actually can sell that electricity as for credits, because it provides greenhouse gas credits. And as you know, you can buy electricity from, you know, green sources, although it's blended because we haven't figured out how to put a little green dye in electrons. But you do have now this duality of recycling water, recycling the gas, and I think this is an exciting future. And we see more and more water treatment plant as in conjunction with infrastructure upgrades to enhance the level of water recycling, and concurrently, you know, move into these other aspects too. So I think it's a very interesting model addressing overall climate change.
It does, and you think also of just something as simple as if your water table is higher, it's less energy to get the water up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's part of the whole, you know, climate mitigation. So these are important principles, and you're preaching the choir. You know, I'm a sewer engineer. I consider that my term is not wastewater treatment plant, or if they say resource recovery center, I say business center.
Yeah. Well, you know, the folks in the room, you can't see the eye contact that I had with Steve, but his eyes were sparkling when I was talking about water treatment plants. So, Mr. Robertson?
Thank you.
That was really,
if you're done, I'll wait till you're done. I have a
no,
question.
I'm done.
Okay,
yeah,
I have a question. I have a question for Mr. Moore, too. So we were talking earlier about budget,
yeah.
And a significant piece of our collective funding comes from the federal government, and I'm wondering if you have any preliminary signals about the coming fiscal year with respect to changes in funding from US EPA.
Yeah, this is a good question. We're gonna have a discussion at the chair's meeting in April, the first Monday of April, about that. You know, because it's a moving target. You know, there was, you know, one day it was going to be cut, the next day there was back. So, you know, we're concerned a little bit. You know, we're very proud of our SRF programs. We have a AAA rating. We're creating jobs, moving that money, matching with local government and infrastructure, a boom that we've not seen, actually. We've spent over 10% of the fund in clean water in the last year or two of a 30-year program. 10% just the last year or two. So we're booming. We actually just issued a bond on this, leveraged our great credit rating, so for the revenue we're generating. So, you know, this is an infrastructure renewal bonanza that we're presiding over, and I think the federal administration wants that. So we're going to try to, you know, convince them to keep the SRF program funded, but, you know, time will tell. And then on staffing, you know, I'm going to get more information on that, and we're going to talk to the chairs. About 15-20% of our staffing is federally funded. But early indications were that wasn't vulnerable. But like I said, things have had a characteristic of change. So no more.
I'm sorry. Weeks. I have a follow-up question based on that. I'm sorry, Steve. I'm sure you can
okay. I hope this is
sit down later.
Boring everybody here.
Just following up on that funding question, how is the WIN Act interfacing with some of the SRF stuff, if at all? And how is that, you know, going to impact reclaimed or direct and indirect potable reuse?
That's a little outside of my knowledge.
Okay.
I don't know the WIN Act. I mean, I've clearly heard of it, but I couldn't give you a good on-the-fly analysis.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else.
That's fine. Are we seeing more just sort of back to the synergies of reclaimed water and energy nexus and all that good stuff and keeping our local resources local? How are we moving forward with direct and indirect potable and statewide projects? And
yeah, that's moving forward real well. You know, we issued a report in December. I don't know if I told you this in December, but we issued a direct potable reuse report, finding that it is indeed feasible to develop the regulations for that. Our indirect potable reuse regs are pending and will be accomplished in the next few months. April was a target, but that's for surface water augmentation, for reservoir augmentation. So, and then also we're committed to updating our recycled water policy. We're going to have a draft on the street in around March 2018, of which takes into account, you know, we're not just irrigating landscapes. We're doing lots of things like drinking it ultimately. And so we're updating the policy to recognize that.
Sorry.
All right.
That's fine.
Well, thank
water
you again.
Water is a many splendid thing.
Yes.
We could go on and on. But, no, thank you for your engagement and interest and your support of the statewide programs here in this region. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve.